Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Politics and civil public discourse appear mutually exclusive these days. The trend of uncivil behavior among Americans transcends every walk of life, from jostling at the baggage claim to marching in the streets. But much of the discourse and the discord revolves around politics and politicized issues. The National Rifle Association raised the ante with this June 29th video, released a week after the shooting at a practice for the Republican congressional baseball team in Alexandria, Virginia.
The only way we save our country and our freedom is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth.
Some are working to, if not turn back the hands of time to a gentler period in American discourse, if that ever existed, help the nation move forward to a more productive style of disagreement. The National Institute for Civil Discourse at the University of Arizona today will launch a grassroots initiative to achieve that in Arizona, Iowa, Maine, and Ohio. Joining us now is Executive Director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, Carolyn Lukensmeyer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Ann. Delighted to be here.
Also, former Democratic U.S. Senator from South Dakota, Tom Daschle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And former U.S. Representative from Arizona, Jim Colby. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
The National Institute for Civil Discourse will launch its four-state initiative on civility today at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Senator Daschle, Representative Colby, you're both board members of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. And from what I understand, most of the members of Congress don't even remember a time when civility wasn't an exercise in futility. How does a nation follow that example? Senator Daschle?
Well, I think it starts with leadership. It starts with efforts to try to find ways to address some of the challenges we're facing today in politics and across the country. Social media has changed the landscape dramatically. In my view, money has had a lot to do with it. The gerrymandering of districts across the country have had a good deal of a catalytic impact. So there are a whole array of new challenges that have come about as a result of changes made, oftentimes, ironically, in the name of reform, that have made things a lot worse. So we've got to address those and go to the real heart. That's really what we're trying to do here.
This sort of political infrastructure of gerrymandering, the money in politics, and social media, too, and how it's being used in politics, those aren't things that are going to change overnight. And how do just changing people's behavior, how does that work against the tide of these other very large issues?
Well, they're not going to change overnight. And I think it's important to keep some historical perspective on this. I just finished not long ago the biography of Alexander Hamilton, and things were pretty vicious back in those days.
Very.
They didn't have the social media, but every group had its own newspaper, and they printed what would definitely be called fake news about each other at that time. So this is not new in American history. You can also go back to the period, the 10 years before the Civil War, and find a very vicious time in the discourse of this country. That's not to excuse it today, because we shouldn't be better than that. But I think a lot of it has to do with exactly the things that Tom has mentioned here. And those aren't going to go away. But it doesn't mean we can't find a way to have a civil discourse, even when you have social media, even when there are other things going on. We should be able to carry on an intelligent conversation with each other.
You know, that's absolutely right. The vitriol from, revolutionary days was really unmatched in history. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, is there anything to learn from history when it comes to the challenges today?
Definitely. I think what we can learn from history is that in each of the instances we've talked about, the idea of America and what we stand for once again provided a unifying force for the country, and things shifted. What I think is different in this case in modern political history, something we've never seen before, is that we're now 8 months past this very vitriolic election, and ordinary people are still vilifying, demonizing, even hating people who voted for the other candidate. We haven't seen that before in modern politics. The last time that happened was the Reconstruction. So in part, yes, all these big system issues, too much money, gerrymandering, social media, we have to work on those. But in the meantime, we have to work on ordinary people's ability to once again sit with each other and listen in order to understand rather than listening to attack. Listen in order to, how did your life experience bring you to do this vote? How did my life experience bring you to do that vote? So what we're trying to do in the initiative, and frankly, we started this because we got messages, emails, social media messages from Americans all over the country, starting during the campaign, red states, blue states, purple states, saying, this isn't okay. People in my church can't talk to each other. I'm afraid to go home for Thanksgiving dinner. So people themselves are saying, we have to do something to bring back what has been normative in the United States, the ability to disagree without being disagreeable or attacking.
You know, after the shooting in Alexandria, members of Congress recommitted to a pledge of civility, and I kept thinking, why is a pledge of civility even necessary? Isn't it implicit in the role of a member of Congress that they will be civil? I mean, what it seems sort of basic.
It does seem sort of basic, doesn't it? Yes, you're absolutely right. I guess my answer to that would be, shouldn't that pledge of civility and civil discourse be in all of our lives, whether we're talking to our neighbors, whether we're talking to our family, whether it's a student talking to their teacher? That should be part of everyday life. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of that in our society today, and that's what I think we need to regain. But certainly, when you get to the level of the United States Congress, when you get to public officials, it ought to be a given that they have a civil discourse with each other.
Yeah. And there are rules. We have rules in both the House and the Senate, probably arguably more rules in the Senate with regard to civil discourse. You aren't allowed to direct your criticism directly to another member. You've got to go through the chair and you refer to them as this gentlewoman or the gentleman. And, you know, we call it linguistic lubrication. But oftentimes people in the heat of the moment, the passion that is oftentimes generated by an issue or by a personality, all that civility is lost. And I think we've exacerbated it these days with social media and the fact that it's so much easier now to be more petulant, more spontaneously petulant. And I think that has created a new environment that challenges our ability to be civil on a regular basis.
Carolyn Lukensmeyer, what will these grassroots initiatives, or what does this grassroots initiative look like? What's it going to do? You want to attract 100,000 people? What's the magic in that?
Well, what we've learned from listening to people is that they are willing to try again. They want their neighborhoods to work. They want their churches to work. So what the National Institute is doing is partnering with all kinds of locally based organizations. Here in Ohio, you have two efforts that have a great track record, Beyond Civility in Cincinnati and the Ohio Consortium for Civility that was formed in honor of Chief Justice Tom Moyer. So we're linking with all those organizations. We provide discussion guides. We train people how to be facilitators. We actually created a software package that you can use on your cell phone. It's called Text Talk Civility. You literally text 89800 into your phone, put civility in the message line, and it takes you through a facilitated conversation about how to really talk and listen with someone who thinks completely differently than you do on a very important issue.
What if you don't really want to talk and listen with them? What if you just want to change their mind?
And actually, we hear that very often. And what we say at this point is there's so many people that are willing. We should first put our effort into people who are willing. And then in their circles of influence, they may bring in some people who today are still really holding on to the negativity of this last election and are still unwilling.
Why start with these four states?
I probably Carolyn, need to answer
okay.
that.
You should answer that. Yeah.
Ohio is a true swing state. Ohio is a place that hundreds of millions of dollars of negative advertising drop in every 4 years. So in Ohio, we actually heard not just from the public, we heard from elected officials and we heard from journalists that they really wanted to try to do something different in terms of all this vitriol in political rhetoric.
What do you mean you heard from journalists? What was the distinction there?
Journalists from broadcast, from internet, from radio, from newspapers saying, we want to shift how we cover campaigns. Ohioans are very upset about the focus all on negativity, on increasing character assassination. If I treat the candidate that way before while we're in the election, what can change once we're governing? So there's been an honest effort to take a different look at how do citizens, elected officials, and journalists work together to change this culture in Ohio.
The chairs in Ohio are Democrat Yvette McGee Brown and Republican Jim Petro. She's a former Ohio Supreme Court justice, and he's a former state lawmaker and an attorney general. They're also two of the nicest people in Columbus, right? How much do they really relate to the people out there on the ground just duking it out on social media? I mean, how do they reach out? How do they change that dynamic if they haven't been there?
Well, the truth is we pick them because they are. They are models as leaders for civility, for respect, as you said, very nice people. And frankly, we looked at speeches they've given in the last couple of years. I was here in Columbus when Yvette gave a speech for the Ohio Civility Consortium. She started out saying, what about our children? What are we doing in terms of this public discourse, in terms of the impact on our children and our grandchildren? So she's passionate about there has to be this interaction with the public to change how the public is behaving, and there has to be pressure from the public on their elected officials to be the leaders that they should be.
But you're not elected officials anymore. You're not in that ilk anymore. How much do you think it's changed? I guess, Senator Daschle, what's not getting done? Are you worried?
Oh, I'm worried a great deal. And I think Washington is about as dysfunctional as it's been in a long, long time. That dysfunction comes from a lot of reasons, partly because of the lack of civility, partly because Congress doesn't spend the time in Washington like they used to. They generally leave on Thursdays, come back on Tuesdays, and try to run the country on Wednesdays.
They don't socialize, for one thing.
Don't socialize. Over 50 members now sleep on their sofas, which is a form of public housing I don't support.
In their office.
In their office, mm-hmm. including the Speaker. So a lot of things have changed. But you look at what's happened in this Congress so far. We're now here at the middle of July, and I'm hard-pressed to point to a major piece of legislation that has moved all the way through to the president's signature. We've had small bills, but that's not the kind of governance that we're looking for. And as I travel abroad, and Jim does as much as I do, but when we travel abroad, I'm concerned about the message we send about democracy and democratic republics internationally as well. How can we be the model for other nations if we can't ourselves be more adept at good governance?
I want to just follow up on that last point, because I've always said there's three or four things that I think contribute to this. And certainly in my time in Congress, you'd begun to see the change about the time I came into Congress, but it accelerated over the years, the 22 years that I spent there. And one of my, when these people say, what are the bad things that have happened? I say the advent of jet travel. Before jet travel, members came to Washington, brought their families to Washington, and on the weekends they would socialize. They'd play games. They'd swim in the pool. They'd play games in the backyard. They'd have a cookout, a barbecue. They don't do that anymore. They come in Tuesday morning. Tuesday night, they've got a fundraiser for themselves. Wednesday night, they're at somebody else's fundraiser. And Thursday afternoon, they're on a plane back to their district. So they don't know each other. I can honestly say my last 4 or 5 years that I served in Congress, I never went out socially for dinner once in the last 4 or 5 years with another member of Congress. And I blame myself for that. I think that's a terrible thing.
Did you talk to each other about that at the time?
We would sometimes talk about it. We'd say, is it a shame we're not doing this anymore? Yeah, I know, but I've got to be at this. I've got to raise money tonight. I got to be over at the making calls back to my district to raise money, or I've got to go to this fundraiser here. And so we did talk about it, but unfortunately, we didn't do that, anything about it.
Jim is so right. The money passion in Washington is just a typical senator now. In order to meet just the average money spent in a reelection campaign, has to spend an average of $15,000 a day. So if you've got to raise $15,000 a day, you're going to be doing exactly what Jim just described, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, not to mention call time in rooms smaller than this where you're calling people you don't know, asking for money. It's changed the dynamic, the environment, the culture of our institutions of governance very, very dramatically.
So there, Carolyn Lukacs-Meyer, before I let you go, there's some very, you know, high wire structural issues going on here with funding, with jet travel, I mean, literally and figuratively. But then there's also this down to earth, human to human contact thing that we're not very good at anymore anyway.
So democracy is really based on a conversation, always has been. The quality of that conversation really matters. At the best times in our politics, that conversation is really taking place openly, lots of disagreements, lots of debates, but we respect each other, we find some common ground on the issues we can, and we move on. We're now in a time where that conversation isn't happening amongst our leaders. That conversation now, it's filtered down and not happening between us, the American people. At the moment, most Americans can't do anything much about the money in politics or the gerrymandering, although in Ohio there's a chance on redistricting for the public to get very involved. But what we can do, we can take responsibility in our homes, in our neighborhoods, in our churches and synagogues and mosques to relearn how to really talk and listen to one another with civility, with respect. If we can't agree on the issue, we at least understand why we think this way. And it doesn't interrupt our ability to have a real quality of life where we live and work.
Carolyn Lukacs-Meyer, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Carolyn Lukacs-Meyer is the executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, which will launch its four-state initiative on civility today in Ohio at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. For more on that, you can check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to restore civility to public and political discourse in America. The National Institute for Civil Discourse at the University of Arizona today launches a grassroots initiative to achieve that in four states, Arizona, Iowa, Maine, and Ohio. They'll be launching that today at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. If you want some questions or comments about that, you can check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Still with us is former U.S. Senator from South Dakota, Tom Daschle, and also former United States Representative from Arizona, Jim Colby. The mayor of Upper Arlington, Debbie Johnson, was among 10 mayors nationwide to pass a resolution to revive civility and respect during the month of May. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So just 10 mayors?
I was asked, and I certainly thought it was a great idea. It's something we've been working on in Upper Arlington after some controversy that we've been through.
Right.
And it was the right thing to do.
How's it going? I mean, how did that go in May? What was it, just sort of a... yeah, we're going to do this, but nothing got done, or what happened?
Well, we did do that. We actually, it wasn't only I didn't do a mayoral proclamation. We actually had a resolution from all of our council. And so our council really passed this. And the other thing that we had done, you know, with the Columbus Foundation, they offered the big table in June. So mm-hmm. We had about 80 people around about eight tables. And, from all, you know, all different organizations within Upper Arlington, really talking about what is it in Upper Arlington that you want to see happen in the future, you know, and why do you love Upper Arlington? There's been a lot of other things going on. Our leadership UA organization did a six words, why you love Upper Arlington. And that was a project that they had done and kind of spurred that on. So there is a lot of positivity that's trying to be brought forward. And so that's a few of the things that we're trying to do.
Last year when the Upper Arlington Council members met to discuss a recall election, mm-hmm. I guess set the date for it, one of the critics of the city council said that you and your colleagues don't listen.
Right.
And in the article that I read, you said that it's not that you don't listen, it's that you don't agree.
Correct.
And that kind of was an interesting thing. I mean, that's a big distinction.
I heard them. I understood what they wanted. I just didn't think that was what was best for Upper Arlington. You know, as an elected official, you do your research and you look at it from all sides, no pun intended, mm-hmm. And then you have to make a decision on what's best for the community as a whole.
You know, there's some lexicon issues here. We have different meanings for different phrases now. We think different things. And a lot of people that got involved in these last couple election cycles, mm-hmm. for a lot of them, it's the first time they've ever gotten involved. And in every election cycle, there's a new batch of 18-year-olds that are able to vote. And they were very frustrated. You know, a lot of younger people voted for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, and they just felt like they weren't listened to at all. It's just because Bernie Sanders didn't win. But what about that, Senator Daschle? I mean, how do you get people to understand and be playing with the same set of the same lexicon, I guess, the same set of words?
Well, the same set of words presents its own challenges. I was lamenting earlier this morning that in this era, truth is just an option, and people assert their assertions as if everything they say is truth. And as the mayor noted, you've got to sort it out, and you've got to make some decisions with regard to what you perceive to be the truth. And I think with social media in particular, that's harder to do. I think it's also created when Jim correctly points out that we've always had fake news going all the way back, but at least when you had to print it, it took some time and it had to be digested. And, you know, now it's all so spontaneous and the interactive experience is much more intense than it's ever been. And I think that's part of the challenge. Members of Congress today actually speak to each other through the media sometimes, you know, the two leaders especially. I see that happen all the time. One leader will say this. The media then asks for the response from the other leader, and it goes back and forth without any real dialogue between the two. And that becomes even more of a problem when relationships break down, which they have with increasing frequency in the Senate and in the House.
You know, and that's a good example of, you know, this return to civility, this pledge for civility that a lot of members of Congress signed after the shooting or pledged after the shooting in Alexandria. It made me kind of wonder. It seems like such a vague notion now. Are there nuts and bolts, things like, no, we will not respond to each other through the media, we'll talk to each other first kind of a thing? Representative Colby?
Those are some of the things that need to be done. They need to come up with a very specific list of the kinds of things they will and will not do. And certainly one of them is to reduce the amount of tweeting and the amount of quick sound bites that they give and to do more thoughtful kinds of responses. But, you know, I go back to what we learn in school and in terms of civility. And we don't really teach. It's all about accepting the democratic process. When you were talking earlier about 18-year-olds voted for Bernie Sanders and were upset because he didn't win. Well, that is the democratic process mm-hmm. that we have. We don't do much about teaching civics in our high schools and elementary schools any longer. We're not teaching those kinds of things. So people don't really have the understanding of how our democratic process works, how the institutions work. And I think we could start at that basis of saying, here's the way it has to work. And there has to be some acceptance of some of those things.
You know, I was thinking when I was reading Debbie Johnson about what, as mayor and along with your fellow city council members, what you went through that last year. Mm-hmm. Some people were like, we came to talk and you won't let us talk. And it's like, well, you got to fill out a slip. Well, we don't know where to get a slip. Well, you can get it this way and that mm-hmm. way. And I wondered if that's not a function of social media, that
sure.
there's that sense of immediacy that we get to gratify ourselves mm-hmm. immediately by just putting it out there.
Right. And also we, you know, asked and tried to sit down with the sides that were disagreeing with us and trying to find common ground. And there was just none to be found. You know, we were there to listen, but they only wanted us to understand it their way.
Have you made any progress since then with these folks?
No, not really. We're trying still.
That was an honest answer.
But at some point, you know, again, my job, my elected position is to do what's best for Upper Arlington. And, we have to move forward because we can't, you know, change is hard. Change is hard everywhere, and especially in our community. And so there are a lot of changes that need to be made, you know, infrastructure and a lot of different things in order for us to be successful in our next 100 years. So it's kind of that mindset of, no, I want it the way it's always been. And or it's this way and the line's been drawn in the sand and I'm not here to compromise, because compromise or collaboration to them is defeat.
Yeah.
Debbie's put her finger on something that's absolutely essential in the whole legislative process, and that is compromise. That's what it's all about, is making compromises. It's not that you're giving in. It's not that you're – but compromises is how you reach a consensus among the most people that represent the most of the country. And it's essential in the legislative process.
And the issue of gerrymandering goes right to the heart of that, because yes, we're electing people at the primary level where they have to just please the
right,
the most common denominator, you know, the farthest left or the farthest right, depending on the party, and not the people in the general election.
That's exactly right, Anne. I mean, the message the base sends to a lot of the elected officials who rely on those primary elections is that compromise is capitulation, and they dare anybody to capitulate. So it's really, that's where it starts. I think and as I said, I think earlier on, the whole idea of having primaries was considered a reform, taking the decision-making process for nominations out of
the dark-filled
rooms. But the primaries now have just given the bases so much power. Dick Lugar was one of those people who lost in a primary, a wonderful senator from Indiana. His name has now become a verb, at least in the Senate. People don't want to get Lugared. And by that they mean they don't want to get beat in the primary. They don't even want a primary opponent, and so they're going to toe the line and not capitulate. That is compromise to avoid those primary fights.
There's hard evidence of what you were saying about the results of redistricting. It's not just a thought, but there's hard evidence. If you match, put all the votes up there that people cast in the Congress of the United States. There used to be, if you put a Venn diagram, the two circles would overlap. There would be some Democrats that would have a more conservative voting record than the most liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. Today, there's not a single one that is true of. So it's shifted everything over to the polar extremes. And so if you're a Republican, you're not worried about who's running against you in the general election, because it's a solidly Republican district. You're only worried about somebody getting at you in the primary. So you keep shifting over towards the right. And the same is true on the other side as well. And that's why the result has been this polarization.
Yeah. In 2014, the Pew Center uh-huh. found that the number of people who identify as strictly liberal or strictly conservative doubled. Mm-hmm. That there's yeah.
No in between.
No in between, and that they're not flexible on anything.
Right.
And it cuts both ways. Scott in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ann. Hey, first of all, I got to tell you, I'm a longtime listener, and I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Related to the comments that you guys were making about the millennials being disappointed that Bernie didn't get elected,
mm-hmm.
and I'm about your age, but yet I still sympathize with what they feel because they're feeling the pain that we all should feel because of the Democratic Party's policy to have superdelegates at the convention. What that means is that that's still a remnant of the influence of the party bosses from way back that the Democratic Party chose to retain, that the superdelegates at the convention just decided they would cast their votes in favor of the Clintons because they felt it was time for the Clintons to have their due. And I was disappointed with that as well, because Bernie did very well with his harvesting around the country of his delegate count, and it could have gone either way, and the superdelegates used their influence to go the other way.
You're right. I mean, that's a very good point. Thanks a lot, Scott, for that call.
Just a quick point on that. The irony is the Republicans were kind of wishing they had had the superdelegates, in which case they might not have nominated Trump as the nominee. But it's a good point.
It's a good point. Scott, thanks a lot for listening, too. Appreciate it. That sense of wanting to have a voice and having an impact and making a change, and it takes time, and there's a lot of organizational barriers to that, whether it's gerrymandering or money in politics or whatever. But people don't feel like they have a voice, and so it sort of explodes on social media, right? It's just our cup runneth over on social media. Everybody has a voice, but they don't all have to say who's talking. You don't have to identify yourself. And someone asked on social media the other day, should we be forcing people to expose who they are, to come clean with who they are, instead of hiding behind, whatever kind
anonymity,
of avatar they want. And I wonder what your thoughts were about that, Senator Daschle.
Well, and I especially when it comes to contributions, I think there has to be transparency.
So the money issue.
Absolutely. I think it's abhorrent that we have a capacity in this country now to donate millions of dollars anonymously. Transparency is a very important part of democracy. There are times when when you have to ensure candor. We had some of the most productive moments in the Senate when we turned the cameras off. And the reason for that was because if you didn't have the cameras on, you didn't have to worry about speaking to your base. You could actually speak from your heart to your colleagues. And that happened especially during the impeachment process that I helped manage in the Senate. Night and day difference between when the cameras are on and when the cameras are off. So there are times when, you've got to take that into account. But when it comes to the political process itself, in my view, the greater the transparency, the better.
Tom and I completely agree on that. We may disagree on some other things, but on the transparency issue and making sure people know where the money is coming from and who it's coming from is absolutely essential. You touched on something else, though, that I think is also important. And while I favor as much light being shed on everything that we do in the governmental process in Congress and certainly in the legislative process, there is a downside to all of that. And that is the cameras in the House and the cameras in the Senate mean that the people, when they're speaking there, are playing not so much to their colleagues, not speaking really to their colleagues, but they're speaking to the camera and they're speaking to constituents and other people out there that might be listening.
And more than ever are listening, because it's so easy to listen and watch now.
Right.
You can carry your phone around and do it.
Right.
Exactly.
Even then, I mean, who watched C-SPAN? They were nerds back in the day, but now when you can carry it around and just put the app on.
As we speak, the
easy.
FBI nominees' hearings are taking place,
exactly.
And every camera has focused on that this morning.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about civility in political discourse, why it matters, and how to achieve it. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If it were easy to do, we wouldn't be talking about it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to restore civility to public and political discourse in America. The National Institute for Civil Discourse at the University of Arizona today launches a grassroots initiative to achieve that. They're kicking it off in Arizona, Iowa, Maine, and Ohio. Still with us are two members of the board on the board of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Former U.S. Senator from South Dakota, Tom Daschle, also former U.S. Rep from Arizona, Jim Colby. They will be speaking today at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. If you want to check that out, learn more about that, you can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, Upper Arlington Mayor Debbie Johnson. She was among 10 mayors nationwide to pass a resolution to revive civility and respect during the month of May. Again, questions or comments, what do you think? What do you think will work? What will make a difference? If you've been out and about over this past election cycle, what did you learn from that? Hopefully not to stay away the next time. Lots of people have blamed President Trump for the breakdown, for his remarks about wanting to punch hecklers at his rallies and during the election cycle, and about his bullying behavior. Other people disagree that they say he's not the cause. He's more of a symptom. Debbie Johnson, what about that?
This has been happening a long time. You know, negative advertising, negative speech works, unfortunately. And so I think this is beyond, I think, what I've ever thought it would ever go. And I think it's Trump's way of kind of taking over the media almost. It's his way of I'm going to be first on the story. I have a hard time hearing it a lot of times.
You know, I listen to every Republican debate over that cycle, and they were all doing it after a while. It wasn't just Donald Trump that was doing it.
Donald Trump is both comments you made are correct. He is the symptom. He's not really the cause, but he's accelerated it. He's exacerbated it. He's intensified it. And frankly, his behavior as the president of the United States is something that really should be unacceptable to all of us. It's not what we expect to have from the leader of this country, the kinds of behavior that he's engaged in and the things that he says about other people is just not acceptable, in my opinion. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Is that hard for a Republican to say? I mean,
not hard for me.
Okay. But you're in the party. I mean, you know, people must have strong feelings about whether or not, you know, Jim Colby should be out here saying this
hard, as it would be for either side, when there's a president who does something that you think is wrong or you have a strong disagreement with, because you want to be loyal, if possible, to the president, though your first loyalty, of course, is to the country. But you also realize that two things. One, to get anything done at the Congress, you have to be able to work with that president. And the second thing is that your base, those that elect you at home, you can't just completely walk away from them, or else you're not going to be effective because you're not going to be in Congress.
I'd like to expand on that just a little bit, because I think it's such a critical point. I agree with everything Jim said, and I don't think it matters whether you're Republican or Democratic. If, you know, if a president isn't providing the leadership, that's not good for the country. I don't think whether it's a symptom or a cause. I think that they're not mutually exclusive. I think he is a symptom, but I also think he's a cause because, as Jim said, he's exacerbated this whole problem, accelerated the decline in discourse. He's broken the norms, and I think what we need more than anything else, and I mean this sincerely, I don't know, I can't think of anything we need more right now than leadership. We need leadership to set the example. You know, it's an exaggeration and probably doesn't even fit in this context, but we need an Abraham Lincoln for civility. We need we need somebody we can look up to and say, this is how you do it. And unfortunately, we just don't see much of that right now, at least at the federal level. We may see it at the state and local level. I think the mayor is a good example of leadership at the local level, shining on and showing the courage he has to step out. But I don't think we see it at the national level like we need, and we need that more than almost anything else right now.
How much is all of this a function of the fact that we're all listening to different things all the time? I mean, I grew up, I know you guys grew up with, you know, the nightly news.
Right, exactly.
We were always watching the same thing. You didn't always agree with it, but we were all watching the same thing. We were all listening to the same
thing. We've seen a major change. I think the media has gone from being the referee to being the participant. Mm-hmm. And when they no longer are the referee, when you don't have a Walter Cronkite calling balls and strikes, you've seen the decline. I was telling Jim earlier that I once in a while make it a habit to watch an hour of Fox and an hour of MSNBC, and you might as well be on two different planets. It's just remarkable, the contrast. But if that's the only source of news, and it is for a lot of people, it's no wonder we have the confrontation and the political environment we have today.
There's such a proliferation of media today that anybody can pick out their little niche that they want to hear on whatever the topic is.
Yes. And to they
reinforce. Can listen to just that to reinforce their own views. And so they never get to hear other points of view.
59% of the respondents in an annual Civility in America survey released last month said that they stopped paying attention to politics because of incivility in 2016. And I want to jump from that to an email from Ben, who writes, "This last election showed me that there really is no need to put support or weight behind a candidate for president. I used to get worked up over elections, yet there is just no need for it. In today's day and age, people just cannot handle the state of politics. To me, most politicians of today are interested in you only when you have a checkbook or if you are a lobbyist." So there's somebody feeling very isolated, very
unheard.
And 59% of the people in there stop paying attention to politics because of that. So who are we left with? Who are we left with that are paying attention?
Well, I'm not sure that Ben's view reflects the majority, but I do think there's a very significant percentage of people that feel ignored and feel as if their voice doesn't matter. I guess my only plea to them is that we can't give up. This is too important, and as frustrated as people are, we just have to be persistent. We have to continue to be engaged. Lack of engagement, lack of participation simply delegates your ability to change to somebody who may have an entirely different point of view than you do.
If all the Bens of the world give up on the political system, then all we're left with are those who have a different point of view and who really come from the extreme ends of both sides of the political spectrum, and that's not good. We can't allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Megan in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for the discussion.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment that I think that the debates, both in the primaries and afterwards, could be better organized and more like a true Oxford debate in modeling proper behavior.
But how do you do that with 10 people or what was it, 16?
You don't have all 16.
Well, I don't know. I think giving each person a chance to talk without being interrupted and really have come to logical conclusions as true debating should do.
I will say, and to that point, that I think the debates turned out to be more entertainment than they did political experience.
Yeah.
And I worry sometimes about the blurring that I see, especially in cable media, about how much of an entertainment factor is at stake as they consider these things.
Well, they've got to keep it going
24/7. Exactly. They have to keep it going. And so these things turn into circuses, really. And the real value, the intellectual value, the value and contribution to the political discourse becomes more and more diminished. And as that occurs, of less and less value. And so we have these sideshows, these circuses that I think demean the political process.
You can't have real political debates with as many candidates as the Republicans had. I mean, nobody gets enough time to have a real discourse or to elaborate on ideas or to respond. You have debates really need to be about give and take. And so there has to be some way to lessen that number that they have out there, which means making some hard choices about who's going to get on these debates or whether you divide them up or some other way.
Yeah. You know, we saw on the news the 80 people who made the human chain into the ocean to save the family caught in the riptide. And I don't think they probably stopped and checked to see whether they were an R or a D or an I, right?
I
mean, there's hope.
There is hope. There is humanity out there. I see it every day. It's very heartwarming. You know, I get social media posts where, you know, the person thanking the person for who was ahead of them in the drive-thru line. You know, or the person who bought the dinner because their baby was fussing and just bought the mother of the fussing baby dinner. I mean, so there is hope out there. There truly
is. I agree.
I
don't think we give enough attention to what's going on at the local level, at Debbie's level. I mean, there really are a lot of good things that are happening. It's just the national media is especially focused on the national – the national landscape, and there's not as much there as there should be. But even there, there are quiet discussions that go on between Republicans and Democrats. But as Jim said, and we've noted, there's just not enough time in Washington today to make that what it used to be.
Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. I think one of the indications, of course, is that the worst possible thing that McConnell could say that, oh, my God, we might have to work with Democrats. I really think that Citizens United took the vileness from retail to wholesale.
This would be the U.S. Supreme Court decision, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. And it's dark money. It's pouring in. And people who are trying to be the grown-up in the room, like Kasich was during the debate, can't get heard over the shouting. And I wanted to remark, I was on the Women's March, and I think that we need to differentiate between rudeness and vigorous public discourse. On the Women's March, I never saw so many acts of kindness and caring in one place. There was not one single incident. It wasn't a vile thing. It was a march of hope. It was a march of protest. But people treated each other well.
So it's possible. Sharon, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. What next? What do you plan to do, Senator Daschle, with this launch, with this initiative at hand?
Well, I think the most important thing, and Carolyn was saying this earlier, I think the most important thing is to focus attention on a lot of the good things that are happening and try to be as catalytic in spreading the word as we can. You know, the four states that we're launching this project today is just the beginning. What we hope ultimately is to get to a lot more states and to be as helpful as we can in creating avenues for dialogue and consensus building, believing that if you start at the local level, eventually you can work your way up. But that doesn't mean you ignore Washington. I think there are a lot of things, as I go back to my leadership assertion, I just wish there'd be more joint caucuses where members of the two caucuses would get together and sit and say, what are we going to do this week together? What could we do together? I wish the president would call the leaders down once a week and say, what can we do this week together? That's not going to – I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. I think we ought to have 3 weeks on and 1 week off rather than one day a week on and just create more of an environment for people to socialize and do the kinds of things we used to do. But so there, I guess my point is there are a lot of things you can do that aren't big that could really be helpful, and we're going to keep pushing for those.
It sounds a little bit like a muscle we need to exercise a little bit more.
Yes, I think so. One of the things I would also add is I really think the media – has to take a good hard look at itself and the role that they're playing today, because they clearly do help accelerate this and intensify all of this. They need to really examine themselves, and I think that kind of self-examination that should be going on in all other aspects of our society really does need to take place among the media. But I do want us to end on a positive note, and as Debbie has told us here, there are a lot of good things that are going on in our communities. And there are a lot of good people that are out there doing good things every day, whether they're taking care of veterans or senior citizens or their families, their parents. So we really need to keep that in mind, too, that there's good stuff happening here.
So the pressure's on the local people, Debbie.
I'm up for the challenge. And I've been working on it for the last 8 years.
That's Debbie Johnson. She's mayor and city council president of Upper Arlington. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, former Democratic United States Senator from South Dakota, Tom Daschle, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And former U.S. Congressman from Arizona, Jim Colby, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Both Senator Daschle and Representative Colby will be at the Columbus Metropolitan Club today to talk about the National Institute for Civil Discourse launch of its four-state initiative on civility. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.